In 1987, when I was born, that was the last year that the concentration of carbon dioxide was below 350. When I got involved in organizing around climate change around the year 2007, the concentration of CO2 was around 380 parts per million. Today, I just checked it earlier today, the measurement coming in from Mauna Loa is 400.26 parts per million, and we're going up. But let me take this out a little bit. Let's look at this across history. So this is from 1960 to today, 2015. But here's a graph that begins 600,000 years ago and then goes out to today. So you can see here that CO2, it changes. It goes up and down, up and down. But it has never been above that 350 level until the year I was born. And for 400,000 years before that, we were vacillating at a much lower level of concentration. And we see, when we look back at the record, that temperature of the planet also follows that vacillation in carbon dioxide. This is something that Joseph Fourier, back in 1827, notice. He said, oh, greenhouse gases, carbon dioxide is one of them. They trap heat and can heat things up. So it's like a blanket that covers the Earth, and as it's getting thicker and thicker as we emit all of these emissions. And so where is this going? Well, this curve is going up. So if we don't stop emissions, we're headed into further unknown territories, like nearly double what geologic time for 400,000 years has seen. This is unprecedented. According to the NOAA, the National Ocean and Atmospheric Administration, 13 out of 15 of the last hottest years on record have occurred since 2000. 15 of the 15 hottest years on record have occurred within my lifetime. This is big stuff. It's happening very quickly, and it's catching the world off guard. This is news from last week. Scientists say Arctic sea ice just set a disturbing new record. The disturbing new record for Arctic sea ice was that the winter maximum, so up here in the Arctic, so the ice builds up over the winter, builds, and then in the summertime, the ice melts back down. So we've heard a lot about the summer minimum, when there's the most minimum amount of ice. But this is that the maximum level, so where the ice peaked this winter, was it peaked at a much lower level than we have ever seen throughout history. This is pretty alarming. And so the countries of the world have gotten together, and they've said, well, we want to hold the increase in global temperature below 2 degrees Celsius and take action to meet this objective consistent with science and the basis of equity. This was came out of the 2009 climate change negotiations. It's called the Copenhagen Accord. There's me, a senior in college, at the beginning of the summit, before the results came in. Afterwards, I did not have so much of a smile on my face, and I was not posing so excitedly in front of the conference poster. But nonetheless, and the result of that came out of that conference was that though nations agreed to that level, they haven't sort of anteed up. They haven't shown that they can deliver on it, and they've made there have been many commitments made, but those commitments, when we add them up, are just a small reduction of where we need to go. So at the top line there is, if we stay the course, we don't do anything, we're heading towards 4.8. That's around 8.6 degrees Fahrenheit. But with all the proposals, we knocked down about 0.7. And this is a little graph that my day job at Climate Interactive, we developed to try and help people understand this, like what makes sense of like all these numbers being thrown around. And the goal was way down there. So, and this is something called the emissions gap. There's a gap between what we need and where we're at. And we've got to figure out how to close that. So, what will it take? I want to pause my PowerPoint for a second and switch over to an interactive simulation. So at Climate Interactive, We create tools to help people see what works to address things like climate change. And my computer will wake up. We'll see that this is one of our tools called C-Road. And so we work in partnership with institutions like MIT to develop these computer models that model the climate and energy system. And to do that, and then we create these tools where you can, we get to see and test out things. Because ultimately, though we are experimenting with our planet and testing out the limits of what our planet can handle, that's not ideal. It would be much better if we could run some experiments on something that we were not, our lives are not dependent on, like a computer model, which is obviously just a very simplified of the rest of the world, but can give us a framework for thinking about things. So right here, we have global CO2 emissions on the left. So that's the current trajectory. You see there in gigatons of CO2 per year. And then across the bottom is from the year 2000 out to 2100. On the left, on the right is temperature change. And so let me make a distinction here. So now I'm talking about CO2 emissions. Before, I was talking about CO2 concentration. So if you imagine, for example, I have this water bottle here. I don't have another water bottle, but I have this water bottle here. So what is in the water bottle is the concentration. The emissions is the flow into the water bottle. If I had a hole in it, that would be the emissions coming out, so the sequestration of carbon. So what we're looking at here is that every year, CO2 emissions is a rate. So every year we emit emissions. What do you all think we need to do if I'm pouring water into my water bottle to make sure that the volume in here stabilizes? You can imagine that. And so let's say, so I'm going to hide this for a second. Global CO2 emissions. Okay. Do we need to stabilize emissions? Do we need to bring them down just a little bit? Or do you need to bring them all the way down? All right, you guys are going to have to get your arms up here. What do you think we need to do to stabilize temperature rise below 2 degrees with our emissions? So every year we emit emissions. Hands up, put your arm at the level you think it is. I see a few. All right, see some curving down a little bit. I see some real dramatic down. I see some leveling off. All right, so let's try this out. First, let's say that we're going to level things off. So I'm going to say that the growth in emissions stops in, and you can see as I move this on the right there, that temperature graph is coming down. So I'm 5 degrees, now we're at 4 degrees. Now we're pushing towards, okay, we say growth levels off in 2018. There we go. If we just stabilize our emissions, so every year we emit just over, you know, around 40 gigatons of CO2 per year, then look at that. We'll reduce the amount of likely temperature change from upwards of 5 degrees down to just over 3 degrees. What do you all think? You think that's possible? You think that's a good thing? Not. Let's look at what that world would mean. Real quick. If we just are talking about stabilizing emissions, we get to around between 3 and 4 degrees. So here is a graph that comes from the IPCC. The IPCC is the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. This is a global consortium of scientists from around the world. Thousands of scientists participate in the IPCC process. They come up with a report every 7 years or something like that, and that says, gives kind of the status on climate science. We look at this. If you see on the right there, you can see where 3 degrees is. Let's see if I can get a pointer. 3 degrees. So that leaves, that puts us in the red zone for nearly most of these things. I can't see what I'm doing really. But you can see here, we have unique and threatened systems. So this is ecosystems threatened by climate change. We have extreme weather events. And you can see at the bottom the spectrum there, moderate, high, very high. Distribution of impacts, very widespread distribution of impacts. Lots of impacts globally aggregated. And then this thing on the the far side over there is large-scale singular events. These are events that are high impact, low probability. We're talking about things like the collapse of the jet stream, where we don't know what would happen, but the implications would be pretty profound for our world. And so those become more likely as well. So we say, oh, we don't, that does not look like the future. I want to see. So what is it actually going to take to get closer to 2 degrees and even lower? Come on, computer, give it back to me. All right. And so leveling off doesn't quite level off emissions because of this concept. And at Climate Interactive, we call it the bathtub, the climate bathtub. If you think of this like a bathtub, emissions are our faucet, turning it on, and the bathtub is full of these temperature and CO2 concentration and things like that. So we've got to reduce things. So let's look at these reductions. We're starting to reduce emissions down, 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 down. Still not there yet. Let me adjust my reduction rate. Make it a little steeper here. We're talking about emissions reductions on the order of 4% per year. We're also going to reduce deforestation a whole bunch, and we're also going to plant a whole lot of trees to promote afforestation. And there, we've got it pretty darn close to 2 degrees. So I want to take a second, and let me see what we've done here. So in the year, this is a global model. So here we are in North Adams. We're in the state of Massachusetts. We're part of the United States. This is taking on the whole world and looking at emissions. So the year that I have set for the stop of emissions is 2018. What year is it? 2015. In 3 years, global emissions need to stop rising. And I have set the reduction rate start year at 2032. And of course, you can play with these things. There are different ways you can look at it. Maybe you say we don't start reducing out further, but we drop faster in the later years, or maybe we start reducing sooner and we don't drop as dramatically. But the point here to take away is that we need to be taking action today. This is, if we are to have any hope that we'll get towards that 2 degree goal or whatever goal you want to get to that creates a livable planet, we've got to be moving really quickly. Which takes me back to, you know, I was saying this in the student discussion before we began, that I'm coming into this wearing a couple different hats. So at Climate Interactive, we have these tools. But really, I'm also talking about my personal responsibility and who do I need to be in the context of this world because the stakes are really high right now. And so I'm also coming in here wearing the hat of someone who's, you know, of the millennial generation, cares a lot about my future, and wants to take action. And so I'm figuring out, how do we take action, and how do we get the political will? How do we make sure we are setting our society, our political landscape, whatever it is that it's going to take to get us to that point where we can reduce emissions? And so part of this is drawing a line in the sand. We've got to get to a point where we are leaving fossil fuels in the ground. And there is a Saudi Arabian oil minister who said, the Stone Age did not end for a lack of stone, and the oil age will end long before the world runs out of oil. Though the business case, the business model of the fossil fuel companies is that they will continue to burn fossil fuels in perpetuity, we have got to figure out the forces that will stop them. There are a number of different forces at play. At the end of this year, in Paris, world leaders are going to come together for another big international summit around climate change. They're going to be working on a global agreement there. The US and China released an agreement last fall saying that they're working together. Those things are insufficient alone. There needs to be massive people uprising. This is a picture I took in Copenhagen in 2009 at what was then the largest climate march in history. This is a picture I took last September in New York City at the current largest march on climate change in history, 400,000 people in the streets of New York and cities around the world calling on nations, Ban Ki-moon, the Secretary General of the UN, and others. Time is now. We've really got to be taking action. And so that's what's going on at the international level. But then also at the national level, we're hearing about a lot of stuff. We hear about the tar sands, the Keystone XL pipeline, which is carrying tar sands from Canada to be refined in Gulfport refineries and then sent who knows where, maybe exported, maybe beyond. And there's been a huge campaign around that, that when it was first proposed, analysts said, this is going to be a done deal. No way that you should even bother fighting this thing. Here we are 3, 4, 5 years later since we've started resisting this pipeline and it still hasn't been built. And the president just vetoed a bill from Congress saying, pass the Keystone XL pipeline. It's become an issue that people know about. Coal plants. These are another very dirty, polluting facilities that have been we're seeing shut down right and left. And last year, I believe it was, the Brayton Point coal plant here in Massachusetts out in the Somerset area, they announced that was going to shut down. One more coal plant among, over 187 that have been canceled or taken offline in light of just, for one, it's financing. The coal is not as cheap as it used to be. Two, it's polluting, and there's a lot of resistance to it. And the thing about shutting down something like a coal plant is that we're looking at benefits that are near-term and long-term. So near-term, shutting down a coal plant makes the community around it much more healthier. We're talking about reduction in asthma rates, just like early deaths from people who are suffering from the different pollutants. Those get eliminated when you shut down the coal plant. And then you're talking about the long-term effects. And locally, I'm with a group called 350 Massachusetts Berkshires. We started last year, about a year ago to the day almost, and we have been doing climate action here in Berkshire County. And so one of the things that we're working on is fossil fuel divestment. And just recently, we took a resolution to the Great Barrington Select Board calling on them to say, will you endorse this, endorse fossil fuel divestment, and call on the state legislature to divest the state pension system from fossil fuels. They signed it, which has implications for the employees of the city of Great Barrington if the state was to divest. They're like the 11th, 12th town in the state that has said, we call for divestment. Other towns include Boston, Somerville, and Truro out on the Cape Cod. That's one of the projects that we're working on. Another project that we're working on is Northeast Energy Direct, the Kinder Morgan pipeline. Hands if you've heard of this. I see a few hands. So this pipeline that's coming across our county, it's a proposed fracked gas pipeline. So it's carrying gas from Northeast Pennsylvania, where it is obtained through hydraulic fracturing, carried up through New York State and out to the coast. And this is our Keystone XL pipeline. This thing is massive, and it's pretty national. It will be national news in time, I'm sure, because it's just the numbers on it are astounding. The other thing about it is it crosses Berkshire County, but where is all this gas going? So right now there's this big campaign to make us think that, well, New England needs gas, and it's going us. But an early Kinder Morgan slide, so Kinder Morgan is the company that owns this pipeline, has a nice arrow headed to the Atlantic, Canada. Guess what's in Canada? Export facilities. So they're not there yet. There's a gas import facility in Canada that they're trying to switch to an export facility. And there's a pipeline called the Maritimes pipeline that goes from Draycott, where this pipeline happens to end, up to Canada. And there's a proposal to flip that. And so it would bring gas from the south rather than bring gas from the north. There's a lot of questions about whether even flipping the direction of pipelines is a good idea in terms of their safety. If they're designed to flow one direction, can you just flip them the other direction? But more importantly, this becomes a global issue very quickly. We're building this infrastructure. It's going to last for a long time. Some of it may go to local customers, but then some of it, you know, really, I think that the gas companies have their eye on Europe. So if we look at just gas prices, so the bottom blue line there is the price of natural gas in the U.S., nearly four times lower than the price of gas in Japan, much less than the price of gas in the EU. And so right now there is not a global gas market. These prices are pretty isolated. Price in the U.S. is the price in the U.S. There's not a lot of trade going on in natural gas. It's a gas. And so it has to be compressed at high pressure and cooled to turn it into liquid, into something that you can put on a ship and get across the ocean. The EU, however, is getting pinched pretty hard right now because of gas. European gas prices rise as Russia limits supplies to Ukraine. We hear about Crimea, we hear about Putin, we hear about all these things in the news. This is about this issue that we've got in our backyards, this pipeline that's 2.2 billion cubic feet, much bigger than anyone says is necessary for the Berkshires or for Western Mass or for the rest of New England for that matter. It's huge, it's massive. And if they can get an export pipeline up to Canada, they can get this stuff to Europe, where the news just keeps coming in. Threatens Europe's gas supplies. Gazprom is the Russian gas company that kind of controls a lot of the gas that comes into Europe. So this is what the pipeline looks like when it's built. It's you see this 50-foot corridor of clear cut, and it just goes straight through the state. This is a picture I took recently in northeast Pennsylvania where this pipeline began on a trip I took. So here's the route. It comes in Hancock currently, and note that this is a map of the current pipeline route. The pipeline route has changed several times since we've first heard about it about a year ago. So this is what we're working with right now. All those little squares around the pink line are the different properties that it's crossing. And you'll notice here that it's crossing the state about 25, 30 minutes south of here. And there's a section of Windsor that is highlighted in red. So Windsor has been identified as the location of a compressor station. So compressor stations are these facilities that are located along the pipeline every 40 to 100 miles, and they compress the gas and push it into the pipeline. They also serve as access points for the pipeline. You can stick equipment into the pipeline through there, and they also serve as places where they do these things called blowouts, where they clean out all the gas in the pipeline and release it into the atmosphere. The thing is, the compressor station that they have proposed for Windsor is 80,000 horsepower. So here's a picture of what one of these facilities look like. It would be pretty massive. To put this in perspective, and I'm trying to do I've been digging into the research. This is data from 2006. So you can see, of all the gas compressor stations across the U.S., you see that 74% fall in the range of under 20,000 horsepower. Then you can see 22%, most of them fall within, you know, under 50,000 horsepower. The compressor station we're talking about for Windsor is in the 1%. We're talking about a 1%er compressor station here. This is blowing my mind right now. This is massive. Why on earth do they want to build a giant industrial facility in Quiet? Windsor is where Notch View is, if there are any cross-country skiers. There's not, you know, it's not a place that you go to see giant facilities. The air pollutants from compressor stations are numerous: carbon dioxide, carbon monoxide, nitrogen oxide, volatile organic compounds, chemicals, formaldehyde, toluene, benzene, the list goes on. And we don't actually know the entire list because we don't know what is in the fracked gas. So to obtain fracked gas, they use this chemical cocktail that, because of something called the Halliburton loophole, doesn't have to be disclosed to the federal government. And so getting the list of the actual air pollutants that might have been the pollutants of all kinds that are in this gas is, we haven't been able to obtain it yet, though a lot of people are working on it. So this is what we've got 25 minutes down the road from us. A compressor station proposed that's to be as big as anything I've been able to find requisite for, and a pipeline that's set to carry gas at huge volumes across the state. So if there was ever a place where we need to say no new fossil fuel infrastructure because of something like climate change, because of land rights, you know, they're going to have to use eminent domain to take a lot of people's land to build this pipeline and all kinds of stuff that's just so problematic. This is the target. Here's a group of people in Sandusfield, Massachusetts, that are saying, no new pipeline. They've got a separate project from Kinder Morgan down in South County. Sandusfield is in the southeast corner of Berkshire County. And the good news is that 53 towns across Massachusetts and New Hampshire have said, passed town resolutions saying, we do not want this thing. Do not bring it to our town. There, you know, our federal elected officials, Senator Elizabeth Warren, I oppose the current Kinder Morgan pipeline. Markey, I oppose this pipeline. All this is really great. The ultimate decision for this lies with FERC, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. So FERC is this body that's part of the Department of Energy, but also sort of semi-autonomous. They get a lot of their funding by design comes from the industries that they are intending to regulate. That's a little bit problematic. And they have a history of sort of rubber stamping these pipelines, saying, oh, you want a pipeline? Oh, you want a compressor station? Sure, we'll pass it. And so, but there are all these citizens across the country who are facing FERC projects that FERC needs to approve. And they're saying, enough is enough. This project, this is broken. We cannot, this isn't working for us. This isn't working for our communities. It's not working for our country or our future. So here's an action that happened last November in Washington, D.C., where they took pictures of families impacted by the Cove Point export facility in Cove Point, Maryland, and said, you know, FERC, face families, you heard. And they set this up in the middle of the street and blocked the way for cars to go and also blocked people from entering FERC's headquarters. This is going to continue to escalate. Last week at FERC headquarters down in D.C., a bunch of activists stood up and spoke during a meeting in which they had made a rule explicitly saying no public comment, and they were asked to leave. This May, there's going to be a big rally, and tons of people are going to be heading down to FERC to continue to engage and work around that. So you can join this movement to influence this process. And I've talked a lot about some of the, like, the resistance. But what about the other side of this? So these are two sides of the same coin. We also have to be building the new and making sure we're meeting our energy needs, in addition to saying we really can't touch any more fossil fuel infrastructure. So solar photovoltaics in Massachusetts are on the rise, exponentially growing. And we're seeing this also at the global level, where we just have these curves where you're, you know, 5-10 years ago, people were saying, oh, PV, I don't know whether it's possible, solar. And PV stands for photovoltaics. So that's the kind of solar panels that make electricity. And they're on the rise. The cost of solar photovoltaic power is plummeting, just dropping. And this is really exciting stuff. Wind power, the price of it's also coming down. While the wind power capacity is going up, this is at the global level. Every minute in Bangladesh, two more homes get solar panels. This is pretty impressive. Even our old friend Al Gore says, the projections made 5-10 years ago for the installation of solar and wind technology were not just wrong, but way wrong. We've seen a dramatic increase that's far more rapid than anybody projected, and it's accelerating. So are we going to win? I don't know. But I know that the only way to win is to try. You're not going to win if you don't try. And so I'm out there. I'm trying to do what I can figure out to do, and I would encourage you all to do that as well. And to close, I want to, I want to do a quick exercise. So everyone, shake out. You've been sitting there listening to me ramble on for a while. And I want you to cross your arms. And I want you to look down and notice which wrist is on top. Registered in your head. Drop your arms. All right, cross your arms again. Look down, notice which wrist is on top this time. Okay, raise your hand if the same wrist was on top both times. I think nearly everyone is raising their hands. So this is something interesting. Huh, what's going on here? Well, we know that people are creatures of habit. We tend to do things one way and we keep doing them. So, all right, let's do a little experiment here. I want you to cross your arms with the other wrist on top. You ready? Go. Good job. So, sit here a little bit. What do you all think? So, this is an analogy for taking action. So, we're sitting here. Some of us had to think about it a little bit to cross our arms. And it's also a little awkward. It doesn't quite feel right. But guess what? It's possible. Taking action on climate change, we're going to have to think about it. It's going to be a little awkward and feel uncomfortable at times, but it's possible. Thank you all. And I'm happy to take questions now.
That was good. Thank you. I understand that, I've been on the 350.mass listserv. So I understand that we do not need this capacity. But I also understand that FERC doesn't take into account whether or not we need capacity. Correct?
My understanding is that FERC is pretty well designed to approve things. So there are people that have quotations that say, they've come out on record, and it's something like, well, we're going to approve this because the company went through the effort to apply, because it takes a lot to apply. And so it's like, well, wait a second, this is... And so I don't know the details of exactly whether the capacity, because they aren't rejecting pipelines right now. They're just sort of saying, yes, yes, yes. And so have been some lawsuits leveled and things like that that get more at that question of, is this really needed? And there have been cases in which companies have pulled pipelines from FERC and said, never mind, we're not actually going to do this. And so there's an example, like in Kentucky, the Bluegrass Pipeline, where there was, I think it was the state that said, we're not down with you taking people's land for eminent domain for this pipeline. And they were holding a pretty good solid resistance to it, and the company backed off. And so there are things like that where something like the need, I think, is less a case for FERC and maybe more a case for our state government who could take action, and more a case for towns, more a case for anyone who might be interested in getting involved.
Well, eminent domain is only legal for a public good, and I don't see how export is a justifiable public good.
Yeah.
But what about Charlie Baker? He seems to be quite in favor of this. What's your feeling on the new administration?
Yeah, I think it's sort of we're trying to figure it out. I know that I talked to someone who testified in front of the Mass legislature yesterday, I guess it was, and she said, and I haven't read this yet in the news, she said that there was a commitment made by Senator Barrett, pressed the governor on what his commitment to fulfilling the Global Warming Solutions Act is. So this is existing legislation we have, and got him on record saying that he was committed to fulfilling that. So, well, that's a step forward, and I think I haven't heard that many comments about the pipeline yet, and this is where 350 Massachusetts right now is gearing up to throw a bunch of pressure his direction to get a little more clarity on this, because it's a little like, where does he sit? We don't know. We know that there are arms of the state government that are are opposing the pipeline, but whether it's cohesive and how the new change in administration affects things, figuring it all out. Other questions?
Yeah, I wonder if you could talk a little bit the carbon tax, and there used to be a concept called cap and trade, and that seems to be something of the past. How do you compare the two? Is one something that doesn't really work and we should forget, or and replace it with a carbon tax? And how would that work?
Yeah, so in 2009, 2010, at the federal level, so in the national level, part of this, like going to the Copenhagen climate negotiations, and I was off as a senior in college off to these climate negotiations, and we were like, this is going to be great. We've got Obama, he's going to pass some great climate legislation. This cap and trade bill is working its way through the Senate and the House. Yeah, and Copenhagen was not that great, and we don't have federal climate legislation in any form, and it's pretty much dead in the water right now. And so that was cap and trade. And so that is a cap on carbon dioxide emissions on big emitters. So a power plant, you own a giant coal-fired power plant, and it emits far and above what's needed or what the limit is set at. So above that, you have to buy credits off the market to pay for those additional emissions. If you're a power plant that's cleaned up your act, and all of a sudden you're not emitting that much, you get credits, and then it's a market-based system. Whereas a carbon tax is just a straight tax at a certain level of carbon dioxide emissions for a facility. And then on top of that, there's a fixed rate and then the revenue. Then you can decide where that revenue goes. And so some people argue that carbon tax is just more simple. It's a little like you can just wrap your head around it rather than this market where things are bought and sold. And we look at the EU right now. So the European Union has the emissions trading system there, and that system is ill. It's not doing very well. The price on the carbon credits there is really low, and so it's just like not even worth it. The buying and selling is not incentivizing any kind of action. And there's a lot of, you can read mountains and mountains of analysis on what went wrong with the EU system and how it could be repaired or whether it should even be repaired, yada, yada, yada. But that's kind of why cap and trade, I think, is getting less airplay these days, is because we see the EU, and we also have just this effort that we're sitting on top of it where it didn't go through Congress. And so the new thing that a lot of people are talking about and the carbon tax legislation that's in, and they would say, don't call it carbon tax, it's carbon cap and fee and dividend legislation that's in the Mass legislature right now. There's two different bills. One of them is, you could call it carbon tax, but they set a level of emissions, and then above that, the large emitters have to pay. And then that revenue that comes from those paying those fees either does one of the two things. In one of the bills, 100% of that revenue goes back to the ratepayers. So it would get then everyone would get a check in the mail, and they would get that back. In the second version of the bill, 30%, I believe, is the number of that revenue would go into transportation. So going to the Department of Transit, going to the MBTA, things like that. So there is a debate, you know, where that revenue should go, but that's kind of where we are at in Massachusetts. I know that Vermont is also looking at carbon tax right now. Oregon's looking at carbon tax. A lot of this is modeled off of British Columbia, which has a carbon tax right now that has been wildly successful in supporting, you know, a low carbon transition while also the economy of British Columbia right now is booming. It's doing well. So we're seeing economic growth paired with a transition towards a low-carbon future, which is what a lot of people are looking for.
I want to ask about the pipeline, Kinder Morgan pipeline, and in particular, what kind of actions could students at a school like MCLA do that would have some sort of meaningful impact and how does actions here, or even at the town levels, where towns are making decisions and passing decisions on this, how does that scale up to affecting the decision that FERC makes to approve or to deny, or pressuring Kinder Morgan to withdraw their application? How does that play out?
Well, I think we're learning, and we're trying a lot of different things right now. So the town resolutions has been a big strategy, and it's worked pretty well here on this pipeline because there is so much opposition. Across, you know, 50, I don't even know if I can name 53 towns across Massachusetts and New Hampshire. And there we have 53 towns that say, no, we don't want this pipeline. Just about every single one along the route. And so even for, you know, select boards and decision makers in towns where they're like, what? We're trying to figure out what this pipeline is. What does this mean? You know, they're like, well, we see that every other town along the pipeline opposes this, so we're not going to not oppose this too. And so it's sort of hit that inflection point of just like, where it's like, yeah, that's the thing you do is you oppose the pipeline as a town. And we saw this recently when they moved the pipeline up to New Hampshire. And so they moved the route. And so all of a sudden you had these like six or seven new towns in New Hampshire, 15 new towns that where the pipeline was running through that it wasn't running through before. All of the towns, to my understanding, all of the towns in New Hampshire that just got the pipeline relocated to have already gotten resolutions passed and said, we're going to oppose this. Like, that kind of turnaround of opposition is fast and pretty exciting. And as far as I can tell, unprecedented in gas pipeline opposition history. We are on a curve here where we can shut this thing down with people power. And that's pretty exciting. So any kind of action, whether it's holding events where people can just learn more about the pipeline, whether it's, you know, getting town resolutions passed, whether it's writing articles and op-eds in local papers and letters to the editor, all of these things. And we're also looking at, you know, more escalated things. People sitting in streets. What does this look like? You know, where across the spectrum of how we can get the world's, the nation's, the state's attention to these issues, there's a lot of different strategies that need to be tried and a lot of strategies that need to be explored. And the good news is that we have the people behind it to try all these different things. So there's a quote from mother scientist and fracking activist Sandra Steingraber, and she says, "It is now time to play the Save the World Symphony. I can't tell you what instrument you need to play, but you need to find your instrument and play it the very best that you possibly can." And that's kind of the way I take on a lot of this work. I don't know what you need to be doing. Just find something and do it.
Yeah. Just to add, also go to FERC.gov, FERC.gov, and you can register and you can make a comment, as many comments as you want. You can mail things in. You can write against it. Obviously, writing to legislators, getting involved, showing up. Find out whatever your passion is and do it. Stand up. But FERC.gov is also a place that, I mean, part of stopping this is to not let FERC give them that permit, which is coming up in January 2016. But, you know, now is the time to be doing that. And all these town resolutions are very, very important in showing that the people are against this, and this has massive effects on that. Is it okay?
It does. It's so important, but the sad fact is that FERC doesn't have to pay attention, right?
Yes, they do.
They do?
Of course they do.
But they can... I mean, they can decide what they want to decide, and it's final.
But that's not final on the actions that can stop this pipeline.
Are there any other comments or questions about things? Here's my email information if you want to get in touch. And also, if you're interested in staying involved in any ways, please come to the next 350 Massachusetts Berkshire meeting. We meet every month in Pittsfield, the third Wednesdays of every month. At 5:30, we have refreshments and meet and greet. And then at 6, we begin the meeting. And I have a sign-up sheet here for anyone who would like more information or to get involved. Definitely find your instrument in this great symphony of action and play it as best as you can. Thank you all so much.